I worked with a man at one stage who talked about the gee whiz stage of group thinking about social problems. He mentioned that as the problem broke in upon people, where there was always great initial enthusiasm and spasms of interest and excitement. And then as the long, hard work of dealing with the problem became clear, why the gee whiz stage passed, and a lesser number of people continued to address the issue. And I suppose that's true of issues in national security and arms control as one thinks about them in the future. Yet their importance is so overwhelming and obvious that it had seemed to Phi Beta Kappa, Virginia, that no topic was more important for the visiting Phi Beta Kappa lecturer of this year than the whole question of the arms race and arms control, arms limitation. So we were pleased in seeing the list of the national Phi Beta Kappa selection of speakers, that Cyrus Leventhal, who has had a long interest in the subject as well as in his fundamental science research topics, was available for the Phi Beta Kappa lecture. Cyrus Leventhal is William R. Keenan Professor of Biophysics at Columbia. He's twice been chairman of the Department of Biological Sciences at Columbia. Began his career at the University of Michigan in 1951, and his early research interests included genetics and the development of bacterial viruses. And that research was continued when in 1957 he went to MIT, becoming professor of biophysics and continuing there until 1968. He went to Columbia University in 1968 and continued his research, emphasizing particularly the practice of molecular modeling by computer graphics, combined with computational analysis of molecular structure. His current research includes the study of gene expression in the developing mouse cerebellum, a topic that has broken in on our public interest. I think the science section of the Times, the New York Times, had a discussion of this subject yesterday. Site-directed mutagenesis of small protein toxin, and computational methods of predicting the confrontation of and conformation of antibody combining sites from their amino acid sequences. He and his colleagues at Columbia have designed a new computing machine for a molecular mechanics computing system at Columbia, and that machine is being built and developed further at the Brookhaven National Laboratory. He's the author of some 50 scientific publications, is a member of the National Academy of Sciences and its Institute of Medicine, and has been involved in educational initiatives both in the nuclear arms field and in the improvement and broadening of medical education. He teaches an undergraduate course, as I understand it, in the subject he'll be discussing today. And so we feel privileged indeed that he is the 1988 Phi Beta Kappa lecturer at the University of Virginia.
Let me just add one point to that rather complete introduction, which perhaps explains my own involvement in this area a bit. And that is that all of my formal academic training was in physics. And I got my PhD in physics just after World War II, when the number of colleagues, friends, associates who had just come back to academia from the projects at Los Alamos and elsewhere working on the bomb were very numerous. And I think many of us from that period have been involved in many ways since that time. Most of our efforts have not been very effective. That hasn't stopped us from continuing to try. But what I'd like to do is to go over some of the history, because it seems to me that so many of the things that have happened in the last 40-odd years give us lessons as to what's going on now and what might be the way in which we can avoid some of the problems in the future that we've had in the past. Let me start out very simply, and just to put a little bit of background to what happened before and during the war. The physics community, the physics activity before World War II was very largely, particularly the area of physics, of nuclear physics, was very largely centered in Germany, in England, to some extent in France, and to a minor extent in the Soviet Union. There was relatively little activity in this country until the late 30s. It was in Germany that the discovery of nuclear fission first took place. That is, the process by which the nucleus of a particular isotope of uranium could be induced to split apart, liberating very large amounts of energy, and amounts of energy which were many orders of magnitude greater than the energy that was liberated in any chemical reaction. And just about the time of the beginning of the war, Leo Szilard and a number of other people in physics realized that this reaction, this fission reaction, could be used to both create energy and create an explosion if the process itself caused the liberation of neutrons, the same kind of neutrons that were used to stimulate the reaction in the first place. There was at that point a lack of knowledge as to how many neutrons would be liberated and whether their energy would be suitable to sustain a chain reaction. But very early on, both in this country and in England, the necessary experiments were done, and it became clear that a bomb could in fact be made. Some of the early experiments were necessary to make an estimate of how much uranium would be needed to make a sustained reaction. One really didn't know very early on whether it was going to be tons or grams or what. It turned out to be a few pounds. And that number was predictable from the experiments that were done early on in the war. Once that was clear, once it was clear that a bomb could be made, the process of actually producing it was something that required a great deal of industrial-type effort. Large-scale plants at Oak Ridge, at Hanford, and a great deal of rather high-class engineering done at Los Alamos and elsewhere in the country. I won't go through the history of the making of the bomb. Suffice it to say, there's recently been a particularly good book on the subject. Richard Rhodes' book on the making of the bomb is probably the most complete book on that period. The thing that is more interesting, I think, from the point of view of the overall history, is what happened after the war. In 1945, the United States had three bombs. The material enough to make three bombs, and that's all that was made by August of 1945. More could be made rather quickly, it was quite clear, but what was actually available in the summer of 1945 was enough uranium and plutonium to make three bombs. One of them was tested in New Mexico, and the other two, as you know, were dropped on Japan, on Hiroshima and then on Nagasaki. The question of our sense of responsibility and guilt for having used the bomb is certainly real. On the other hand, I think to put it in perspective, one has to realize that bombing raids on Tokyo and on Dresden, single bombing raids, had caused a number of deaths quite comparable to the deaths caused in Hiroshima with one bomb. So we were rather immune to the idea of large-scale suffering, both because of what we had done in wartime and certainly because of what the Germans had done during that comparable period. One of the interesting things that happened during that period was a committee that was chaired by Dr. Joachim Frank in the spring of 1945, before the first bomb was tested. The Frank Committee wrote a report, which was later released, which was directed towards the President and the senior officials in the War Department. In that report, they argued strenuously that it was important to start immediately trying to develop some method of international control of nuclear power and nuclear weapons, pointing out that if that did not happen, and we went ahead and used the bomb, the Russians would certainly develop one in a short period, and from then on, there would not be easy to control an arms race. The Frank Report is a very moving document. It did not reach the President. It's not clear it reached anybody of any seniority in the War Department. And it was only published rather recently. After the war, one of the interesting aspects of the period immediately after the war is that General Groves, who had been in charge of the project during the war, believed and in fact convinced the rest of the political establishment and most of the population of the United States that the Russians would not be able to build a nuclear weapon for a very long time. And it was thought of at that time as the winning weapon, the weapon by which the United States could maintain control for decades. The basis of Groves' belief that the Russians could not build a bomb was twofold. One is everybody knew the Russians were peasants and they couldn't do anything like that. It took a large effort on our part. And there are three reasons, really. And secondly, most importantly, the notion that it required raw materials, uranium, and Groves apparently believed that he had established a monopoly of the source of uranium. He'd made contracts with the Belgians and the South Africans and other places where there were known deposits of uranium. For some reason, not totally clear, he ignored the fact that Madame Curie had used deposits in Czechoslovakia to obtain the uranium for her experiments where uranium was first identified. And furthermore, there was no particular reason to believe that there were not uranium deposits in the Soviet Union. In any case, the belief in this country, very, very widely held, that we had the winning weapon and the Russians would not have one for many decades was very, very widespread, except in a rather small scientific circle who knew what the capability of Russian physicists were, knew that in fact there were no particular secrets involved in making a bomb, and knew that the only real problem was the industrial effort that could be mounted, and clearly that could be mounted at whatever level the Soviet government decided it wanted to mount it. There was a secret, of course. It was a secret that apparently prevented a corresponding effort in Germany. And that is, not knowing what these numbers I referred to earlier were, not knowing what the probability of one of these neutrons from the reaction inducing further reactions, not knowing how many neutrons came out, the secret was, could a bomb be made? Once we exploded the bomb, that secret was out. Once it was clear that the bomb worked, there really was no more secret. There were tricks as to details of how to put the thing together, but there were many ways of putting it together. And the notion that the Russians gained very much from the information they got from Fuchs, I think has been in general pretty much exaggerated. They certainly got some information. But as I say, the real problem was to mount the industrial effort, which was very large. The plants at Oak Ridge and at Hanford were major enterprises and would probably not have been possible in Germany during the war after the Allies had control of the air. But in any case, the effect on the United States, and I'm sure many of you here remember that period, the effect on the general political scene in the United States when the Russian bomb was first exploded was enormous. The assumption that it must be espionage, that therefore the whole problem was the communists, led to the McCarthy period and the Rosenberg trials and many of the events that we can now so easily deplore were, I think, in many ways a consequence of the shock that was produced when the Soviets exploded their first bomb. The time interval between our first bomb and the Russian first bomb was 4 years, almost exactly. And that turns out to be a number that keeps coming up. The time interval between when we initiate a new military system, a new tactical system, a new development of any kind, and the time when the Russians develop a corresponding system has averaged about 4 years over the 40-year period. It's varied, of course, from as little as a year. One case in which the Russians did something first, and I'll come back to that, and a few cases where the Russians were much delayed. But in each of these episodes, the decision to go ahead in this country was based on the fact that we had a technological advantage and that we must make use of our technology, which is the one strength we have, or a large strength we have vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. We do have a technological advantage, and it has led to the fact that we were able to develop many of these new systems significantly before the Soviet Union, particularly if by significant you take the time 4 or 5 years. On the other hand, of course, each of these events, each of these developments, gave a secret to the Russians. As soon as we had tested some new system, the Russians knew it was possible. And conversely, when they tested something, we knew it was possible. And those were frequently the most significant information that one could provide. The decision to go ahead with the hydrogen bomb was made in 49-50, and there was, again, efforts made on the part of a few people in the scientific community. In that case, it was I.I. Rabi and Fermi, arguing in the Atomic Energy Advisory Committee, Scientific Advisory Committee, that research to go ahead with the hydrogen bomb should at least wait until one had made a serious effort to get a treaty with the Soviets. That was also ignored, of course. On the other hand, in retrospect, it seems very unlikely that one could have gotten the treaty with the Soviets at that time. I think the paranoia of Stalin, which we now understand pretty well, would probably have precluded the Russians from agreeing to any verifiable treaty to stop the research on the development of the hydrogen bomb. At any rate, it went ahead and we both have them. The argument that we should delay the development of the hydrogen bomb was based on the fact that at least with the atomic bomb, there's some limit to how big the explosion can be. It can be large, it can be devastating, but there's some limit to it. Once one starts on the hydrogen bomb, the fusion bomb, there's virtually no limit, and the raw materials are essentially infinite. So one can make those weapons as big as one wants, and as you know, the bombs have been made which are 100 times more powerful than the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They're not much in use now. The largest bombs that are apparently in both sides' arsenals are in the range of 500,000 tons of TNT. Not the pea shooters of the kind that were used in Hiroshima, Nagasaki, of the order of 15 to 20 kilotons of TNT. The Hiroshima bombs were so small that bombs like them on somewhat smaller, few about that size, are now small enough to be used as artillery shells in the advanced forces in Germany on both sides. We've gone through, since that period, we've gone through something close to 100 projects to develop new bomb designs. Each of these projects, of course, involves substantial groups of engineers and scientists facing interesting technical problems, well-funded, and obviously it was important for them to be able to test what they'd done. Otherwise, it wouldn't be fun. And besides, there was this continual sense that if we could make smaller bombs, bigger bombs, quieter bombs, bombs with more neutrons and less destruction, they could all be useful. And in fact, that those developments did lead to the fact that we could have bombs small enough to be used as artillery shells. The numbers during this period are rather interesting. By 1950, 5 years after our first bombs were made and tested and used, we had about 450 by 1950. The Russians at that time probably had one or two, as we did at the end of 1945, because they just exploded, made their first test. About 5 years later, in 1955, we had almost 5,000. And the Russians had about 20. Now, I can't vouch for the accuracy of the 20. I think it's pretty clear that the 5,000 is a pretty good number, because that's now been released. The 20 are the best estimates of the intelligence community. In 1957, there was the second great shock. And that was the time when the Russians put up Sputnik, and the same year they tested an ICBM, an intercontinental ballistic missile. This produced a shock in this country, which did not have quite the political effect as the first Russian bomb. For one thing, it was hard to argue that it was all due to spies, since we hadn't done anything like that yet. And so those peasants had come a long way. But in any case, the shock was severe, and the intelligence community, or at least parts of it — there were debates in the intelligence community — but one of the groups in the intelligence community that was asked to make an evaluation of how many ICBMs there were on the Russian side during this period just after 1957, and they estimated a large number. And their estimate was based on two things. It was based on the fact that the Russians had developed an ICBM, and if we had been in that position, we would have produced hundreds in the years immediately following their first development. And so it was assumed that the Russians must have produced hundreds. And that information was leaked, and it led to what was known as the missile gap. We had a bomber gap before the missile gap. But the missile gap is one that I'd like to talk about a bit, because there's a story that Jerome Wiesner tells about that period. He was an advisor to President Eisenhower, part of the scientific advisory group, during that period. And he was asked by Kennedy to be a member of Kennedy's campaign staff. And Wiesner says that he asked Eisenhower whether he could join the Kennedy campaign staff, and Eisenhower agreed that he could, but he said, of course you cannot use any classified information, because Eisenhower felt that it was necessary militarily to keep from the Russians the knowledge as to how effective our U-2 planes were and our early satellites were, surveillance satellites were. So Eisenhower felt very strongly that he did not want the Russians to know about our capability of their of surveillance of their land territory. And so Wiesner was in this curious position of working in a campaign where his colleagues were touting the missile gap, and that was certainly one of the significant parts of the initial Kennedy campaign. But he wasn't able to tell them that there wasn't any missile gap. Although it was clear to Eisenhower, it was clear to Wiesner that in fact there was no missile gap, because they'd been looking for the missile sites in the Soviet Union and they weren't there. McNamara tells that when he was first inaugurated, first put in office as Secretary of Defense, he was told that there wasn't any missile gap, and he says he couldn't quite believe it. Because after all, he and his colleagues had been talking about it for such a long time. And so he says that he spent 3 weeks with one of his colleagues looking at the photographs of the Soviet Union, being sure that somehow they'd missed the pictures, they'd missed seeing the missile sites. And after looking at them for 3 weeks, he concluded, as other people had, that there were still the three or four sites that the Russians had in 1957, and nothing more. However, by that time, the production facilities for our ICBMs were well in place, and there was clearly no way they were going to be slowed down. And in fact, by 1965, we had some 1,000 ICBMs. And by that time, the Russians' estimate had 225. McNamara says, and Wiesner says, and Herb Bjork has said, that once the development of the technology had taken place, once the production had been initiated, there was no way politically that that process could be stopped. That the pressures to continue the production, continue the employment, was so great that it was not possible to stop it. Let me go on directly to what seems to me to be the next very important development, although there were several in between. And that was the fact that in 1966, the Soviets initiated an anti-ballistic missile system around Moscow. This was one situation where their development of a new system preceded ours by a substantial period. The reaction to that event was also very great, not so much publicly, but certainly within the government, within the defense community. The reaction to the Russian ABM developments was very strong. And the reason, of course, is simple, because if one believed that prior to the development of the ABM, we had enough missiles to deter the Soviets from ever using theirs, then clearly, if they could shoot down some reasonable fraction of ours before they landed, then we would no longer have enough to deter their use of their bombs as a first strike. And so it was clear that we had to do something. Now, during the period, before that period, the individuals, people working in the weapons labs, had developed a new way of shooting missiles. That is, they realized and developed the technology so that one launched satellite could carry several warheads, and that each of these warheads could be independently targeted, MIRV. That was one of the many developments that took place in the weapons labs. Developments of that kind, of course, the initial research on them, the initial development, doesn't require any political approval, doesn't require any congressional action. It's just part of the ongoing research in the weapons labs. As in any research lab, there are always large numbers of projects which have not yet reached the point where they're mature. On the other hand, with the development of the Soviet ABM system, the pressure to develop MIRV was enormous, because that way we could increase our offensive force and thus overwhelm the Soviet ABMs. McNamara, who was Secretary of Defense, strenuously opposed an ABM system on our side. He and the president at that time tried very hard to convince the Russians that there should be an ABM treaty. And McNamara quotes Khrushchev as being furious at the proposal, saying, defense is moral, offense is immoral. A phrase one has heard more recently. And that there was no way the Soviets were going to discuss abandoning ABM. That was in 67. By 1962, the situation had changed, and there was an ABM treaty, a treaty prohibiting the development of anti-ballistic missiles. It was a good treaty. It was effective for many years. Maybe even is still effective, it's not totally clear. But the words of the treaty are pretty straightforward and unambiguous. On the other hand, the fact that there had been an ABM treaty, one might have thought, would obviate the need to go ahead with MIRV, because that was the original reason for developing it. And in fact, when MIRV was initially approved, development of MIRV was initially approved, there was more or less of an agreement that if there was an ABM treaty, they wouldn't continue it. On the other hand, by the time the ABM treaty came around, MIRV development was much too far advanced, and there was no way of stopping it. Now, the development of MIRV is really a very significant part of this whole development. It led to what is now known as the window of vulnerability. And the argument is very straightforward. If each side has 1,000 launchers, each with one warhead, and one is reasonably optimistic about their guidance systems, one can estimate that on the average it would take about 2 attacking missiles to knock out one missile site on the other side. The probability of a kill would be about 50%. And that's a number that has stood up and has been the same estimate for many years. So that if each side had 1,000, each with one warhead, the attacking force would be able to fire all of its 1,000 and knock out half of the other guys, half of the defenders. So after the first attack, the attacking force would have none left, and the attacked force would have 500 left to do with what they wanted. Now, it's not a very pretty picture, because those 1,000 would have knocked off a large fraction of the population in both the defending and probably the attacking country because of radiation. But in any case, it would not be a very practical process for the attacking force, because at the end of that first attack, the attacked would have more missiles than the attacker. With MIRV, all that has changed. With MIRV, the side that attacks first, with one, if you use the same numbers, with one launcher, assuming that launcher fires, has of the order of 6 to 8 independently targetable warheads, then that one warhead could knock out 3 or 4 of the attacked missile sites, since they're at one position. At that point, the attacker has an advantage, has a perceived incentive to attack first. Now, of course, that all assumes that the only thing that either side has are land-based missiles, which the other side can see, and during that same period, partly for that reason, we and then the Russians had developed submarine-based ICBMs, which are not attackable because they can't be seen. But in any case, the result of the development of MIRV certainly made the United States less secure than it was before the development of MIRV. And I think that now is a conclusion that everybody I've ever heard discuss the issue in the military would agree to. Air Force people, Army people, and so forth. General Jones, who is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has indicated such, and reasonably high officials in the Air Force have all said the same thing. That the development of MIRV was a terrible error from the point of view of our security. Now, you have to understand what that means. It wouldn't have been a terrible error if the only thing that had happened is that we had MIRV and the Russians didn't. And that, of course, was the calculation that was made at the time of the deployment, that we have it and the Russians won't. And that has been the kind of calculation that has been used repeatedly over the last 40 years. And you may even see some remnants of it if you read the current newspapers. We have a technological advantage, we must pursue it. Now we do have a technological advantage. Whether in all cases we must pursue it is obviously an open issue. The net result of all these developments were that with respect to strategic weapons, we went from 2 bombs that were used in 1945 to about 10,000 strategic warheads now, and the Russians also now have about 2,000. President Reagan has made the statement that the Russians escalate their bomb production when we escalate ours, and if we stop ours, they also build more bombs. He put it more graphically, but that's essentially what he said. And if you look at the numbers, he's right. That's exactly what happened. On the other hand, what he doesn't say when he makes that statement is that at all points during that period, we had a significant advantage, if you call it an advantage. We had significantly more warheads than the Russians at all points, whether we were reducing or increasing. And so they've been playing a catch-up game until the last few years, when they and we now have about the same number of virtually everything. The number that's frequently quoted is not the 10,000 on each side strategic weapons. The number that's frequently quoted is 25,000 on each side. That includes the tactical weapons. They're a very large number of weapons, battlefield weapons, small peanut-sized things like the Hiroshima bomb. And these are the ones that could be used to protect Germany by shooting him at Germany. That's an argument that always seems a bit curious. At any rate, the recent treaty, the INF treaty, is, in my view, a very significant treaty. Not because of the number of weapons that it will eliminate, because the number are very small. It's a few percent of the total. But because, for the first time, it really initiates on-site inspection, which should make even the most suspicious comfortable that cheating is not possible. The question that comes up is, should we trust the Russians on any sort of a treaty of this kind? And my answer to that question is certainly not. Should we trust the Americans? Certainly not. Should Reagan trust the Americans? No. Should Gorbachev trust the Russians? No. We've seen in the last few years enough evidence to know that we shouldn't trust what goes on in all parts of our government. So there's no reason to think that, as a nation, we should trust everything that we go on in all parts of the Soviet government, and vice versa. On the other hand, can verification be carried out effectively? And there, I think the answer is quite clearly yes. Verification can be carried out very effectively with a rather limited amount of on-site inspection, but some. We don't need to have inspectors inside every factory, inside every lab. We do need to have them outside of factories. We do need to know what comes out. And in particular, we need to be able to monitor, and in my view, we should want to prevent testing of new missiles and new bombs. Because the great danger, as I see it now, is not so much that there will be an increase in number, or that a treaty limiting the number would not be abided by, because that's rather easy to verify, the numbers that each side has. That is to say, it's easy to verify if we're talking about going down from, say, 25,000 on each side to some smallish number. It would not be easy to verify, I think, if one tried to go to zero. If one tried to really eliminate nuclear weapons, one can see many reasons why that might be difficult. It might be difficult to know whether one side or the other was cheating at the level of a few bombs. On the other hand, if one could get a situation where each side had some number of the order of 50 or 10 or 100 or even 200 nuclear weapons, that one can envisage a situation where there could be reasonable level of stability and rather confident verification. Confident verification in the sense that it would make no difference if one side or the other cheated with respect to a few bombs. It would make a difference if you cheated with respect to a few bombs if you tried to have zero. It would not make a difference if you cheated with respect to a few bombs if you were at the level of 100. 100 is probably not enough to endanger, especially if they're single warhead missiles. It's probably not enough to allow either side to consider a first strike, either on their own part or the other side. The question of whether we can get there, of course, is a political question. It's a political question, and there will be an enormous resistance to going to that level. On the other hand, one should keep in mind the fact that 100 or 50 or 20 bombs could devastate either country, could basically destroy either country's ability to survive in the sense that we demand a high level of technological continuation for this country or the Soviet Union to survive. We require the ability to use a large amount of liquid fuel, otherwise we don't have a transportation system. We require that we be able to use a large amount of electricity. If those were eliminated, we would all go hungry. We would all be in a position of being able to eat only what we grew in our backyards. And that would not sustain anything like the population that we have or that Europe has or even the Soviet Union has. So that the ability to destroy a highly technological society is comparatively easy. We're vulnerable. We're all vulnerable. We're vulnerable in the sense that a relatively small number of these enormous weapons can prevent the continuation of the kind of technological society that we're dependent on now. Can we get there? Well, obviously nobody knows. It seems to me that whether or not we get there will depend to a considerable extent on whether there's any public awareness and public pressure for us to get there. On the other hand, there are new developments coming along, which, in my view at least, would lead to further instabilities. I won't talk about Star Wars because there's been so much discussion of that that I'm sure you all know. I mean, the general conclusion, I think, of most people who know anything about it is, A, it won't work, at least not in the foreseeable future. B, if it came close to working, it would be easy for the other side to mount a defense against it. And we can talk about that later if anybody wants. The other thing which is coming along, which is much less well known, is the fact that our weapons and the Russian weapons have had an accuracy which is not great enough in general to knock out missile sites if they're heavily protected, except by using many and getting very close, mostly by chance. Another thing which is coming along, which is much less well known, is the fact that our weapons and the Russian weapons have had an accuracy which is not great enough in general to knock out missile sites if they're heavily protected, except by using many and getting very close, mostly by chance. New bombs, new missiles, are now in the works, which have what's called terminal guidance. These are the developments which came after the smart bombs. Namely, it's a warhead that has a radar system on it, which can make a map, a radar map, of the ground it's about to come into. It has small jets that can change its direction, and it has a stored map of the target, of the area where the target is. And these systems are not beyond our present technology to make a bomb which in fact has an accuracy of the order of 20 meters. That's not very far, sort of like over there. A hydrogen bomb landing over there would not leave anything over here very comfortable, even if it was surrounded by a good deal of concrete. So one is now talking about bombs which can be used easily as first strike weapons. Now, the answer to that, whenever it's brought up, is to say, but obviously we're not going to make a first strike. That everybody must know that. And I believe that's true. On the other hand, General LeMay, when he was in charge of the Strategic Air Force, said we should make a first strike because we had an overwhelming force. Many of General LeMay's statements were about as terrifying as the statements we know are made by Russian generals, that they can win a war and the like. So the fact that we may know that we would never make a first strike does not necessarily mean that everybody else will know that we would never make a first strike, or that the military on either side can make that as an assumption, that our political process will not let us make a first strike. Clearly, we have not made that assumption about the Soviet Union, and it's virtually inconceivable that all the Soviet generals will make that assumption about the United States. One can hope that Mr. Shevardnadze and probably Mr. Gorbachev would make the assumption that we will not make a first strike, and both of them, I assume, would also make the assumption that they will never allow the Soviet Union to make a first strike. But that doesn't avoid the fear that many people in our society and many people in the Soviet society must have about the intentions of the other side, assuming that the other side has the capabilities of carrying out these things. So my own feeling is that Star Wars will go away. It'll just sort of gradually disappear, and it's not going to be a big thing. It'll take a very long time. And during that period, the realization of where we would be if both sides had it, or both sides mounted defenses against it, will become very clear to a large fraction of our population. With respect to the terminal guidance system, that's not the case. It's happening very quickly. There's very little discussion of it. It's a clever technology. It's one in which we certainly have an advantage over the Soviets. It'll probably take them about 4 years to catch up, maybe even a few more. And the question that I would like us to be debating seriously is, are we better off or worse off when both sides have submarine-launched missiles which have terminal guidance on them? And my own feeling is we would not be better off. Russian submarines can play around quite close to the east and west coast of this country. If they have missiles with terminal guidance similar to the ones we're putting on our new submarines, the D-5s that are going on our Trident II submarines, it seems to me we would have good reason to be worried about our ability to maintain command and control, our ability to do lots of things, if there should ever be any outbreak of activity. So, as far as I know, the final testing of these new missiles has not quite been done. They have not yet, although there being now discussion of deploying them on our Trident II submarines. If these developments could be slowed down, it seemed to me, and if we could get an agreement from the Russians not to test or deploy missiles of this kind. And I think we're still in an early enough stage so that if such a treaty could be reached, if such a treaty could be signed, that the development has not gone far enough so that it could not be stopped at this point. On the other hand, once either side has tested these weapons, then it seems to me the possibility for stopping the process has gone. Because once one side has tested it, the other side will know, okay, they know how to do it, they have a production facility, they'll make a lot of them. Just as we assumed there would be a missile gap. So it seems to me there are ways of slowing things down. There certainly is more reason to be optimistic now than there was a few years ago. But whether we can really get to the point of achieving any real reduction to lead to a more stable situation, I think will depend on whether there are enough people who really work and work seriously towards that end. Thank you.
We have time for just a few questions. Anyone would like to ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
My questions, I put them in plural, may not relate exactly to what you're talking about. But how many countries have the bomb now? Because I have a feeling that the trouble when it comes is not going to be Russian and United States. It's going to be the Arabs and the Jews, or the Indians and the Pakistanis. And after the action starts, it'd be very difficult to stop. Could you make any comments along that line?
Well, I think we know what countries now have the bomb. United States, the Soviet Union, England, France, China, and Israel. I think the evidence that we have now that Israel has hydrogen bombs is rather overwhelming from the man they just put in jail. the question as to whether or not that will spread is also, the answer to that is also pretty clear. There are a number of countries which have certainly a sufficient level of technology to make atomic weapons and probably hydrogen weapons. Whether that's a likely prospect for where things will begin seems to me will in fact depend to a considerable extent on what the great powers do. If the United States, the Soviet Union, China, and the European countries were really agreed that A, they will reduce to a significantly low level, and B, that they will guarantee the security of everybody against any use of nuclear weapons, seems to me we might have a chance. The fear you raise certainly is legitimate and the one that I think worries most people. I think the immediate fear is that a country like Iran could conceivably get a small number of bombs from the Chinese, say. Now, I think that's unlikely, but one certainly can't rule it out. The question then is, would Khomeini be deterred from using his small number of bombs if he knew that Iran would be destroyed if he did use them? Well, if you ask the people who are holding the Kuwaiti plane now, I suppose you'd get one answer, which wouldn't be terribly encouraging.
One way to get to heaven.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, one sees a level of that sort of fundamentalism from the Shiites, from the fundamentalists in the West Bank of the occupied areas of Israel. One sees it in many parts of the world. So I don't dismiss your concern at all. I just think that it is going to be up to the major powers, however, to prevent it.
Other questions?
What is science doing on this whole?
I'm sorry.
What is British science doing?
Well, it's hard to know exactly what British science is doing. I can tell you what the British government is doing, which is perhaps more relevant. They have a significant number of nuclear missiles now, something of the order of 1,000 or so. They are about to MIRV them all and increase the number of warheads to several thousand. So are the French. At least in Great Britain, there's a great deal of opposition to these moves, at least it's vocal. In France, one doesn't, at least I haven't seen much of it. But both England and France are increasing the number of warheads that they have and will have over the next 5 or 10 years.
Eric Raymond.
Yes, it seems that over the past 40 years, the U.S.-Soviet superpower war has been prevented by the threat of mutual assured destruction. Do you think that there is a point of low levels of nuclear weapons such that there would be the nuclear balance would be too stable and would prevent a conventional war? It would be too stable to allow a conventional war between the superpowers.
Well, I guess it's not. I mean, I have the sense that the prospect of a major conventional war between the United States and the Soviet Union has been and will be impeded as much by the prospect of what the consequence of a so-called conventional war would be, as well as by the prospect of of a nuclear war. There's a funny thing about considering what we now call conventional war as though it's an all right thing. Those of us who have any recollection of World War II realize that so-called conventional war, 40 years after World War II, without nuclear weapons, would be an incredibly awful thing. We have developed methods of delivery. We have developed bombs which are not nuclear bombs. So that it seems to me that the issue is, won't conventional warfare be prevented simply by the consequences of conventional warfare and by the fact that we would then, I think, go back to a situation which has been the common military wisdom for many years before nuclear weapons, namely that it takes something of the order of a 3 or 4 to 1 advantage by the attacking force over a defending force in a if you're not using nuclear weapons. So that it seems to me that the prospects of a warfare without, of major war without nuclear weapons is not particularly great. I would assume that particularly in the next several decades, after our experiences in Vietnam and the Russian experiences in Afghanistan, neither of us thinks that an attack is easy. At least one would hope that both we and the Russians have had some learning experience from those events. Yeah?
John Ray. How serious do you consider the danger terrorists might gain access and use weapons of mass destruction, such as nuclear weapons or biological weapons?
I don't think the danger of biological weapons is very serious. I think there is a greater danger of simply chemicals, because they're more predictable, we know what they can do. There's no question about the fact that one could poison the water supplies of virtually any city in this country without using anything fancy like biological weapons, but just stuff you can buy as rat poison, or other more toxic things. So I think that certainly is a danger. The question of whether terrorists could use nuclear weapons is really the same question we were talking about before. They're not going to do it on the sly. It's not that small an effort. They would pretty much have to be given either the almost complete raw materials or the bomb itself. If they were given the purified raw materials, then virtually anybody could make a bomb. But that already is a major enterprise.
Yeah, I mentioned before thanking our speaker once more, two other lectures that are being planned. Professor Ashton Carter of Harvard University is going to speak under the auspices of the Miller Center on April 28th at 7:30 in the evening on the future of defense and space negotiations, especially those surrounding ABM questions, in Kaplan Auditorium in the law school. April 28th at 7:30 p.m., Ashton Carter, who one of the rising stars in the national security field. He is both in the science field with his degree in physics, but also at the Kennedy School at Harvard. And then as part of a continuing series on technological literacy, sponsored by the Division of Humanities of the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences and the GTE Foundation, a lecture on April 21st at 8 p.m. in Gilmore Auditorium by Daniel Zwerdling, who's a correspondent with National Public Radio, speaking on the topic, Engineers and Consumers, Why Can't They Speak the Same Language? I suppose one of the most happy aspects of this Phi Beta Kappa lecture is that this fatal two-culture
schism that often exists between scientists and humanists is seemingly obliterated in the two-day stand that Cyrus Leventhal is making. If he survives the 2 days, and he's about also to depart on an airplane for the Middle East shortly, but if he should survive, it'll be noteworthy that in contrast to most speakers, he will have spent the first day with those of you and us who are concerned with political policy problems, and then the next day with the natural scientists at the university. And in an era where the president of this university and others have encouraged interdisciplinary exchange, this is more than paying lip service. It's actually drawing on the enormous talents of a Columbia University scientist who is talking to all of us here. And we hope that there will be future opportunities to meet again with Cyrus Leventhal, who has many friends and many admirers at this university. Thank you very much.